Welcome, everybody, once again to the 94th Assembly District debate between the Democratic incumbent Representative Steve Doyle and his Republican challenger, Tracy Hopple. And so in a few minutes, they're going to give you an opportunity to tell you more about themselves. But before that, I need to do a couple of housekeeping reminders. If you have a cell phone, please make sure that it's turned off or the sound is off. And also, please refrain from applauding throughout the debate. Let's save that for the very end when we're done. And so before you come up, Tracy, you can come up if you'd like. I'd also like to say that they might not know this, but they both have something in common, and that is that they both received their undergraduate degrees from this fine institution. So I have to show you my bias instantly. And my name is Jeremy Arney, and I'm a political science public administration professor, which is also happens to be a co-sponsor with this debate, along with the Tribune and with WKBT Channel 8, the League of Women Voters, and we have Wisconsin Public Radio, and also the UWL Student Association that was sponsoring this. So the format is each candidate will get 3 to 4 minutes for an opening statement, and then we will go to the panel and ask questions, and they'll have about 2 minutes to answer a panel question. And then if they would like to respond to the statements made during that question, they'll have 30 seconds of a rebuttal. And so we flipped a coin before the debate, and Representative Steve Doyle won. And so he will get to do his opening remarks first, and then he will also receive the first question from the panel from you, Maureen. And to introduce you to the panel, we have Maureen McCollum from Wisconsin Public Radio, Mark McPherson from WKBT Channel 8 News, Chris Hardy, editor of the Cross Tribune, Brad Williams, reporter for WIZM Radio, Ellen France, representing the League of Women Voters, and Bob Schmidt of Today's Talk on 1490. And our timekeeper for the debate is Jane Kleekan of the League of Women Voters. Thanks. Steve?
Well, I would also like to start by thanking the sponsors of the debate tonight. And Jeremy already mentioned the names, but I think that it really is an important thing that we're doing tonight. If we had more debates and fewer attack ads, I think democracy would be much better served. And this is really what democracy is all about, people coming together to listen to what the candidates have to say, to listen to a free and open debate. And so I'm proud to be a part of that. A few days ago, my wife, Gloria, who is here in the audience today, sent me an email that had a quote from John Kennedy in it. And it really summed up what I believe in. And so I want to start my comments by reading that quote. John Kennedy said, "Let us not seek the Republican answer or the Democratic answer, but the right answer. Let us not seek to fix the blame for the past. Let us accept our own responsibility for the future." And that really, in a nutshell, is what I believe in. And I'm not going to plagiarize it, since that seems to be the big issue these days, but I am going to refer to that, because that really is what democracy should be all about, is that it's not a matter of who's right and who's wrong, but can we find some common ground? I was born and raised in La Crosse County, grew up here. My wife and I were married here. We raised our children here. My parents, who are both here tonight, live here. And I am proud to be part of La Crosse, because I think we are different than the rest of the state. And I say that all the time. When I go to Madison and I see that hyper-partisanship and just the anger and the vitriol among my colleagues, sometimes I'm almost ashamed that that is what politics in the state, and unfortunately even in our country, has become. And that isn't the way that it should be. You know, I grew up in La Crosse, one of six kids in our family. My parents worked very hard. They were a great inspiration to me. They were great role models to me. I learned the value of hard work. But being one of six kids, I also learned that there is a really important thing that everybody needs to learn, and that is compromise. If we work together and each gives a little bit, we can all get a lot. And when you're one of six kids, you're not always going to get your way, and you're going to have to learn to work together. And that really is a lesson that we need to learn in our government, especially in state and federal government. After I grew up, went to law school, I came back here and I got elected to the county board. And that started my political career in a nonpartisan environment, which is really the same kind of attitude that I took to Madison, even though I'm now in a partisan environment. I eventually became the county board chair and served in that position for almost 10 years, and really found that by working together with everybody, and there weren't D's and R's on the county board, but there were certainly liberals and conservatives and moderates, but I found that when we worked together, it produced something really valuable, something really meaningful. And the best example that I like to give people is when we talked about expanding our jail here in La Crosse County, we did a good job of it. And I looked next door to the people over in Monroe County. When they tried to do the same thing, they ended up having a recall of half their board members, and they never did get it done in that particular vote. On the other hand, we got a unanimous vote in La Crosse County on a project that both sides, the people who were pro and people that were con, came together and said, this will work. That's really the message that I've tried to take to Madison. I got elected right after Act 10, so I like to say that I did not suffer the post-traumatic stress that many of my colleagues did, but I really did learn that there is a lot of anger that we need to cut through in Madison. It's getting a little bit better. I believe that I'm part of the answer to that, because I have always tried to make sure that my colleagues in my party didn't have to agree with the other party, but at least had to respect the other party. I like to talk about bipartisanship, and a lot of people come up to me and say that they agree with that philosophy. But I want to explain what bipartisanship is. Bipartisanship doesn't mean that I am a Republican. I mean, I'm a Democrat. I'm proud to be a Democrat. I agree mostly with Democratic views. But bipartisanship means that I'm respectful of the opinions on the other side. I'm respectful of their validity in being elected to office. And I'm respectful of the ideas that they put forward. So really, I don't care if it's a Democratic idea or a Republican idea. If it's a good idea, I want to get behind that. And that, to me, is really what we need more of in the state. And if I'm reelected, and I hope that I am 2 weeks from now, that is my pledge, that I'll go forward and do exactly the same thing that I've done the last 3 years. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Thank you, Dr. Heim, the Political Science Department, UWL, our panel. Thank you very much. Mr. Doyle, thank you for coming out tonight. And to all of you who are here tonight, to really think about who you want to vote for, follow through on the democratic process. This is wonderful to see so many faces here this evening, and I didn't expect it. Wow, thank you for that. My name is Tracy Happel. I'm the fresh face. I'm the new person here in this whole arena. And I want to tell you about myself a little bit. I lived in Wisconsin most of my life. I grew up in a suburb out of Milwaukee. I came to this area back in 1992. I came here looking for a great opportunity for higher education here at UWL, and I got that education. I also met my husband here. Not that he was at UWL, he just happened to be in town. And we decided to make a life here. We have 3 children. We've raised them here. We love it here. It's beautiful. I'm also an educator. I've been an educator for almost 25 years, and in education, I've been a leader in education. Given that, the Association of American Educators had me as their director for a while, and I was also the first teacher in our state to be appointed to the bipartisan group as a commissioner of education for the state of Wisconsin. When I attended some of those meetings, I learned that our region is in desperate need of legislators and other people, teachers and policymakers and everybody who are willing to put their own interests aside for the interests of the people within this region. So I started thinking about running. I started talking to some community leaders, and I was encouraged to do this, to take a step into this area. And I knew as soon as I started talking and hearing about some of the issues and living some of these issues that are going on, I knew I needed to get involved. So here I am. I'm out talking to people, and I'm hearing that my ideas that I'm hearing out in the district, they're coming together, they're all working together, and I want to be a part of that. Bipartisanship, you know, we hear a lot about bipartisanship, and bipartisanship doesn't mean talking to people across party lines and saying, I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, I'm going to go with your side. It's not your side, my side. What it is listening to people and hearing ideas and sharing in those values and ideas. I've been, I told you I've been a teacher for a while, and most of my teaching career has been working with people with disabilities, specifically the deaf and hard of hearing community. I taught special education for 16 years. I've been a board member for a statewide advocacy group called Hands and Voices, where we advocate for families and children who are deaf and hard of hearing. Through that, my daughter and I were able to speak at Senate hearing committees here in Wisconsin. I've advocated for people with disabilities in Minnesota at the Senate level. I've also worked with families and children in private schools, in public schools, and currently at the Northside Elementary School, where I'm a teacher. I work with families who are in high poverty. We have an 85% poverty rate in my school. I have an enormous amount of experience working with all kinds of people all across the board. That's what bipartisanship is understanding where people are coming from, understanding what they're needing for their family, for their livelihood, and being able to communicate that with everybody, Republican or Democrat. But don't get me wrong. There are times when politicians have some moments of clarity, and they embrace values on the other side of the lines. But in this case, in this particular case in this region, I'm not seeing that with some of our leadership here. Fiscal responsibility, educational choice, and fewer tax burdens are some of the things that I'm seeing that I'd like to address a little bit further, being an assembly person. It's what my campaign has been about since the beginning, thinking about other people, what's best for our families in this region, and that's what I will continue to do should I be elected on November 4th.
This thing to warm up. Mm-hmm. Our first question from the panel will be coming from Maureen McCollum of Wisconsin Public Radio, and you can address it to Representative Doyle, please.
There's a debate underway as to whether or not the minimum wage should be raised to $10.10 an hour. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this issue and also how it would affect not only workers but businesses in the region if it were to change.
Thank you. That is probably the question that I hear most often out on the street these days, my position on minimum wage. I'm in favor of raising the minimum wage. It hasn't been raised for a long time. In fact, even raising it to $10.10 barely gets it to where it would have been if it had been indexed along the way. There's a perception out there that the people who receive minimum wage for their work these days are mostly teenagers. And actually, that's not true. 90% are over 20 years old, and two-thirds are women with children. And if you look at what a minimum wage will get you for a year's work, that's about $15,000. And take a look at what $15,000, if you have a family of two or three people. Well, first of all, you're going to have some rent. And let's say that, you know, that's maybe $800 a month. By the time you're done paying, you know, pretty close to $10,000, that means you've got $5,000 left over for gas, food, clothes, diapers, whatever else you need. You cannot raise a family on that kind of an income. People are also of the perception that if we raise the minimum wage, that we will actually lose jobs. 13 states that have raised the minimum wage so far have all experienced job growth. And in fact, of those, four of those states are in the top 10 for job growth in this country. So really, if you look at minimum wage as an economic development tool, it will spur the economy because the people that make those wages then will be able to go out and buy televisions and refrigerators and put more gas in their car and go to restaurants on an occasional basis and so forth. That is good for the economy. Minimum wage raising is good for the economy.
I do not think raising the minimum wage would help the economy at all. I think that it would be a very short spurt growth, and then it would go back down. In some of the states where they've raised the minimum wage, that's what they've seen. They've seen a quick growth and then a nosedive. Minimum wage jobs are not meant to be something to sustain a family on. They are meant to be entry-level jobs, and then you work your way up into something that is more challenging. You're meant to start somewhere and build up from there, always improving yourself as a person and as a member of society. My concern is raising the minimum wage, and then how are you going to recoup that money paid out for wages? Business owners are not going to want to give that out of the goodness of their heart. I mean, hopefully they would, but it has to come from somewhere, and it's going to go back on the consumer and affect our economy.
Second question from Mark McPherson of WKBT Channel 8 News goes to Tracy first.
Common Core standards have been rolled out in Wisconsin to mixed results. In fact, some people, when they look at the math portion of Common Core, it looks like another language to them. Are you in favor of rolling back Common Core in Wisconsin or staying the course and seeing if it works?
I love this question. Thank you. Absolutely. I'm a teacher. I teach in public schools. I've been in public schools the majority of my career. I have taught around the world. I have taught in even a different state. Standardizing education, having everybody reach the same level, the same time, the same place, does not work. I see it every day in my classroom, every single day. I am in favor of trying to find another way to have high standards in our state of Wisconsin. We used to have them. They're called the Wisconsin Model Academic Standards. We had great success with those standards. You'll hear people say that they weren't so hot based on the WKCE testing results. That was a problem with the KCE. That was a problem with testing, not with the standards. Common Core has such a myriad of issues. The standards are just the beginning of what the problem is with those. Our kids are unique. I have three children. Not one of them is the same as the other. They are very different, and every one of the children in my classroom is very different. Common Core state standards, right from the get-go, right from the title, tells us that we all have to be the same. Take a look around the room. Not one of us is the same. We cannot have the same standards for everybody because everybody is unique.
I really hate the fact that education has become a partisan issue because that is bad for our kids. Interesting story, in the state of Indiana, they adopted Common Core and people were just all outraged. They thought that was a horrible thing, so they decided they would repeal it. They then had a study committee that put together a package, and you know what they did? They changed the name. So they don't call it Common Core anymore, but it is the same thing, almost word for word as Common Core, and everybody thinks that that's great now, because politicians have stuck their nose into education. I've also been an educator. I taught here for 22 years, and I believe very strongly that we have no higher calling than the education of our children and our young adults. And I have had a chance over the course of the last couple of years to talk with every school administrator in my district, a member of every school board in the 94th district, and many, many teachers. And the answer that I get when I ask them, what do you think about Common Core, is it isn't perfect. There are some issues that need to be dealt with. But please, state, get your hands off of that. We have school boards for the purpose of what? Educating our children, right? Shouldn't we give them the opportunity to decide whether we should stick with Common Core or make changes to it? I firmly believe that if the state backs out, and by the way, the school districts are telling me, for example, in La Crosse, we've already spent between $1 million and $1.5 million. Don't make it even worse for us by telling us that you're going to pull the rug out from under us and we're going to start over. So I firmly believe that we give the local school boards autonomy to deal with that issue as they see fit, and we politicians deal with the things in Madison that we should deal with, but education of our K through 12 kids is not one of them in this respect.
Can I say something? Okay. That's a very common response. The cost of Common Core, implementing Common Core, has been astronomical for our schools. It was, money is an issue, but why keep spending money for something that is not going to work? We have lots of other options, lots of other ways to develop standards. It's not just a money issue. It's a myriad of issues.
And just one quick comment. I defer to the experts. And in my opinion, the experts are the school administrators and the school board members, and I haven't had any of them tell me that they want the state to repeal Common Core. Not one.
Next question from Chris Hardy, editor of the La Crosse Tribune. Steve will go first.
Staying on the theme of education, in the last budget, Wisconsin expanded the private school voucher system. A recent report by the Wisconsin State Journal revealed that Wisconsin taxpayers have paid about $139 million to private schools that ended up being barred from the state's voucher system for failing to meet requirements. What is your position on voucher expansion and accountability to taxpayers?
My parents went to Aquinas High School. That's where they met. I went to Aquinas High School. I actually have paid my own way through. Keeping with that tradition, we sent our children to Aquinas High School. I never, ever expected the taxpayers to pay for me or for my children to go to a private school, because that was my choice. And when people talk about the idea of school choice, there is certainly school choice. You can go to Logan or Central or Onalaska or Holman or West Salem, whatever you choose if you want to shift around in the public schools. But we have one public school system that we are paying for right now. We cannot afford to pay for two school systems. If you take a look at a person in a situation, for example, who maybe is retired, they're on a fixed income, and they're having a hard time making ends meet. They look at their property tax bill when it comes in December, and they just shake because they don't know where the money is going to come from. And now to tell them, we're going to take money out of the public schools that they're funding, even though they don't have children in, and we're going to move that elsewhere, but yet we're still going to have to figure out how those schools are going to survive. And maybe that's going to mean to make them serve or to allow them to survive, we're going to have to raise taxes so that we're now adequately funding two school system. To me, that does not make any sense at all. If people want to go to a private school, they certainly have the ability to do so. But the fact that taxpayers are paying money for one school system, to me, says that there isn't enough money to do two. I live in the town of Onalaska. I get fire service from the town of Onalaska. Holman Fire Department. Should I say, my parents who live next door, I'm going to use their hose if I have a fire, so I shouldn't have to pay into the fire department. It doesn't work that way, and schools don't work that way either.
Parents are children's first teachers. Parents know what is best for their child. We choose our doctors, we choose our dentists, we choose our attorneys. We should be able to choose our schools as well, and vouchers allow us to do that. The accountability that you brought up, that those schools that disappeared with all that money happened before we had a legislation to uphold accountability for the private schools that are receiving vouchers. That's no longer should be an issue. We have accountability in place. But vouchers allow families to go where a child flourishes best, where a child can grow best in the and educational environment where they grow best. It creates competition, which creates everyone, all the schools, to do that much better. Vouchers help education. We don't use vouchers, but we use choice. We have our kids going to different schools. For a while, each kid was in a different school. We understand the impact of education, and when parents are empowered to choose that future for their child is going to do that much better and do better things, bigger things in society. We're always going to need public schools. Taking taxpayer money away from public schools, that's not true. Taxpayers are always already paying in tax money. They're just getting some of that back and then giving it and said, okay, what do you want to do with it? This is what I choose to do with it. If you choose to stay in a public school, that's great. If you choose a different type of education for your child, that's great too, because that's your money to start with, and you can do what you want with it.
If I can respond very briefly, there, in fact, is not accountability at this point. I respectfully disagree in that regard. In this last expansion of the voucher program, the Senate Republicans had one idea for accountability. The Assembly Republicans had a different idea. The governor had another idea yet, and so nothing passed. I mean, there was no accountability package that was passed. We do not have accountability in the voucher system at this point.
Next question from the panel. Brad Williams, reporter for WIZM Radio, goes to Tracy first.
In state government, from the governor's office on down, we hear a lot about job development and growing jobs in the state. And over the last few years, there's been much talk of bringing companies from outside, whether it's iron mine or another type of business. What would you prefer the priority of the state to be, bringing in some new jobs from outside, new companies, or trying to develop the ones we already have in Wisconsin?
I think, jobs in Wisconsin, that's a major focus of our state right now. Growing jobs in Wisconsin, where we can have jobs in our state, having our residents in our state employed, even in our district employed, If we need to grow the jobs, we can do that. If we have outside people coming in, that's great too. The more people we have coming in, the better for the economy. The jobs that are currently here, the more we can do to help them along, to deregulate, help them with taxes, whatever we need to do to grow and expand, that's going to also help our economy, help people get employed, and keep our state strong.
I think given the choice of priorities between bringing in new jobs and developing existing jobs and existing companies, the obvious answer is to develop what we have, because that's a known quantity. Most jobs these days are created by small businesses, and as an attorney, I have a lot of small business clients. I do a lot of advising of small businesses, and so I've had a chance to talk with them about what are their concerns with regard to government, especially state government. And they tell me things like taxation and regulation and just confusion. They have, you know, this hand telling them one thing, that hand telling them another thing, and they just need somebody to help guide them through. And given those opportunities, they will be happy to create more jobs because it's good for them, but it's also good for our economy. People often say, you know, government can't create jobs, the private sector creates jobs, and that in very large part is true. But government can either help or hinder the private sector to create jobs. A couple years ago, Senator Schilling, who's here tonight, and I sat down with a group of economic development professionals in La Crosse County, and we said to them, you know, we would like some suggestions for job creation, and they came up with some really good suggestions, one of which was a bill that I introduced in this last session that became one of only 31 Democratic bills and the only bipartisan jobs bill to pass the legislature. It didn't cost any money. It was a way of working with the private sector to develop their resources and their ability to create jobs so that they could grow and put people to work that had been looking for jobs at that point. A really good example of a win-win situation, the government working with the private sector, Democrats working with Republicans. That's really what it's all about.
Next panel question, Ellen France, League of Women Voters, goes to Steve first.
Thank you. Some would say that allowing the party in power to draw the boundaries every 10 years during redistricting creates a situation where you have non-competitive races, a lot less interest from the voters. So my question is, do you support establishing a nonpartisan group to do the redistricting process every 10 years?
Imagine getting that question from the League of Women Voters. Thank you, Ellen. I have said this repeatedly. What we have in this state is a fiasco. It's undemocratic. And if the Democrats were in control, they would have done the same dang thing. I mean, and that's an unfortunate fact of life. And in states where the Democrats are in control, they did the same thing. It doesn't make it right. I would absolutely support the Iowa approach to having a nonpartisan commission established to do redistricting. You know, if you look at in many states, but I'll use our own state as an example. In the state assembly, we have 99 assembly districts. There are maybe four or five of us that are actually on the bubble. I represent a district, I'm a Democrat, representing a district that is maybe 48-49% Democratic. If I am super one way or another, I'm going to be out of a job. And so that forces me to be in the middle and forces me to listen to both sides, even if I didn't want to. We don't see that around the state, however. In Milwaukee, for example, you know, if you're a Democrat, your biggest threat is going to come in a primary where another Democrat is more liberal than you, so you become more liberal, and they can't beat you. If you live outside of Milwaukee in the suburbs of Milwaukee, you're a Republican, and your biggest threat is from another Republican who's more conservative than you, so you become more conservative. What that means is that the Democrats are here, the Republicans are here, and there is this huge gulf in the middle where they're not even speaking the same language. That is wrong. I mean, we need to change the situation so that we have the voters choosing their representatives, not the representatives choosing the voters. And I will absolutely introduce and co-sponsor a bill to accomplish that. And if we have a situation where we had the last two go-rounds where there's split control in the legislature and the governorship, we'll have the courts make the decision, and that probably is another reasonable situation because then you don't have the politicians calling all the shots.
Redistricting gives the state, the people within the state, a chance to have fresh ideas coming at them, having a new group of people with different ideals coming together. Government was created by the people for the people, and when there's new districts every 10 years, that's a great way to come together, a possibility to come together, a possibility to talk about different approaches to issues that are facing those districts. You know, should I be in the assembly when I'm in the assembly? That, you know, that's something that I'll support, is redistricting and working with people across the region and helping new ideas come about.
Last panel question from Bob Schmidt of today's talk on 1490.
A few states have passed medical marijuana laws this year, and a couple more will be voting on making recreational use for adults 21 and older in the next election cycle here. Wouldn't it be beneficial for Wisconsin to start collecting some taxes and legalizing marijuana?
Medical marijuana, did you say?
Either one.
Just either recreational. Okay. You know, marijuana, illegal substance use, not okay, ever, anything, whatever it is. We have to look at what other states are doing. It's hard to decide. No one's been asked. The general public hasn't really been asked. Sure, there's chatter around and there's discussion in groups and among friends and things, but nothing's really been approached by as a state. We need to look at what other states are doing and then think about what we want to do in our own state as far as that goes. But any sort of recreational use, illegal substances, legalizing it, you know, we have to talk to the people about that. That's a subject that's open for discussion with all the residents.
In this last session of the legislature, we passed a bill that would be a step away from the medical marijuana, and I never get the name exactly right, but it was cannabinoids, where it is a derivative of marijuana, where it is used for specifically medical purposes, prescribed by a doctor and dispensed through pharmacy and so forth. I supported that. I think that passed unanimously or near unanimously. More generic question of medical marijuana. I know people who have acute illnesses that are incredibly painful. They have tried everything, and the only thing that is giving them any sort of pain relief is marijuana. And unfortunately, as things stand today, they're using that marijuana illegally, but that is the only thing that gets them through the day. I think we owe it to those people to allow them to, under controlled circumstances, to use marijuana for strictly medical purposes as prescribed by a doctor. In terms of recreational marijuana, I know that there is a movement across the country that perhaps we should consider that. A couple of states have legalized recreational marijuana. But honestly, I'm not there yet. And sorry, college students, that's probably not what you wanted to hear. Maybe I'm just an old curmudgeon, but I'm not there yet. You know, when I see in my practice as an attorney the problems that we have with alcohol, I'm not, and people say, well, it's not as bad as alcohol. It doesn't mean that because one is not as bad that you should just say, well, okay, it's not as bad, so let's just do it. I think what we need to do is have a lot more research on that. Like I said, I'm just not there yet on recreational marijuana, but certainly medical marijuana I am.
Okay, we've finished our first round of questions from the panel, and so I'm going to ask each candidate a question from the audience. Steve gets to answer this first. Since student loan debt has exceeded $1.2 trillion, what role, if any, should the state have in reducing cost of education for student loan debt?
There is a proposal that the Democrats have been pushing called Higher Ed, Lower Debt. When you look at the incredible burden that student loans represent to not just our students, but to our economy in general, it has now exceeded that of credit card debt. When I graduated from college, I had virtually no debt. That was in the good old days when we had grants, and I didn't actually take out any loans until I was in law school. Today, my daughters, who we're paying their tuition, they're paying their housing and collateral expenses, are going to graduate with debt that is more than a car loan for many people, and sometimes bigger than a modest home loan by the time that they are done with school and if they go to beyond the post-secondary education level. That hurts our economy as a whole. And so the proposal that we put forward is not one that just says, well, we're going to wipe out student loans. We're just going to forgive those student loans. Nobody's really talking about that, at least not in this proposal. What we're talking is giving them the opportunity that homeowners have with regard to their mortgages, which is to consolidate them, to refinance them when the interest rates are down, to lower the interest rates, to allow them to have a tax deduction for the payment of those student loans. Because those people who are graduating from our schools today are the engine of our economy for the next generation. And if we set them back where they're not going to be able to buy homes and cars and pay their bills, as I said before, that hurts our entire economy and not just them. So it's short-sighted for us to say, well, I made it through on my own. I was tough and I was able to survive, so they should have to do it too. That's short-sighted. It's not good for them. It's not good for us.
Personal responsibility. If you choose to go to school and you take out a loan, you should be required to pay it back. Credit card debt, the same thing. I have an undergrad degree, I have a master's degree, and I'm currently obtaining a doctorate. I went through my first two degrees, thank God, without any student loan. I have student loan. I plan on paying every penny of it back with my hard work, with making amends in my family and cutting back spending in my family. I don't expect anybody else to pay that back. I don't expect anybody else to take responsibility for that. That was my choice, my decision. Personal responsibility, fiscal responsibility, you make a choice. You need to be responsible for it.
I'd like to do a brief follow-up. And I'm not saying that we should absolve them of their loans. I'm saying that we should be realistic. And maybe it runs in my family, my parents and myself and now my daughters, but each of my daughters has two jobs. They are working their way through college trying to make ends meet, and they are still in the situation because college tuition is so expensive these days. They are still in the situation where they have to borrow.
Yes.
With being in school, I work full-time. I'm also a part-time waitress. I'm a full-time mother. You still, personal responsibility, I chose to go to school. I'm going to pay that loan back.
Okay, we'll start the second round of questions from the panel. Maureen McCollum of Wisconsin Public Radio, you'll be asking Tracy first.
I want to ask about women's reproductive health care issues as well as abortion. Over the last few years, the legislature has passed a number of laws addressing some of these issues. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on some of the laws regarding women's health care and abortion. Do you feel as if the legislature went too far? Do you think they did just enough? Do you think more could be done?
Women's health care is an interesting issue. I'm a woman. I care about being healthy. It's a great question. I don't think it's really a women's health care issue. Health care is for everybody, should be for everybody. But if you want to focus on abortion, I'm endorsed by Wisconsin Right to Life. I believe life is a gift from God. I don't think it's a choice. I don't think it's a method of birth control. And I think that if you're going to use it for that, it's not an option for birth control. I'll leave it at that.
Well, I agree that women's health is a lot more than abortion, and that is one of the unfortunate things that we have seen in this last session of the legislature is that women's health in general, not just on the issue of abortion, has really gotten pushed off to the side. I mean, it used to be that we were really concerned about things like annual checkups and mammograms and all the things that go along with that and providing safe and adequate contraception. That's all gone by the wayside, and that is just wrong. I mean, that's short-sighted for our society in general. With regard to the issue of abortion specifically, I mentioned before, I was raised a Catholic. I'm still a Catholic, I believe that abortion is wrong. I believe it's a sin. But I am not the Catholic representative to the state assembly. I am the 94th district representative of the state assembly. And when I got sworn in, I put my hand on the Bible, and I raised my hand, and I said, I will support the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the state of Wisconsin, so help me God. And the Constitution of the United States has been interpreted by the highest body in our country to require states to allow, under certain circumstances, women to have abortions. That is the law. I'm not running for the Supreme Court. I'm running for re-election to the State Assembly. I'm not in a position where I can change that law. So I have voted against the proposals to change the law that have been put forward by the majority party in the legislature because I believe that they are a violation of the Constitution. It has nothing to do with my personal opinion on that. It has to do with my role as a representative of the people swearing to uphold the Constitution.
Sorry, a spider just fell on me.
Next question from the panel, Mark McPherson of WKBT.
Well,
oh, yeah, you can.
I think I can respond.
If the spider's okay.
He's dead. He's squished over there. Sorry.
That's health care.
No right to life for spiders. What life is a gift. No one gets to choose that but God. And my opponent, you know, I understand that when you're in the legislature, you have to do what's best for everybody in the district. The district is 53% Republican. Most of the people I talk to are against abortion.
Mark McPherson, WKBT News 8. Your first question goes to Steve.
Both of you in your opening remarks have talked about reaching across the aisle, listening to the other side and being bipartisan, and eventually you can't just say it, you have to prove it. So can you name for me one issue that the other side largely supports that you would be willing to support?
I do more than that because I have a number of situations where I have crossed over. There was an issue that came up this last session relating to shoreland zoning that the Democrats were opposed to, but I was contacted by some of my local realtors saying, you know, this is not one of those huge fill-in-the-wetlands kind of things. This is a modest type of a proposal that would really help our community. Would you support that? I did. The issue of double dipping that was introduced by Representative Dewey Strobel, which is the big double dipping bill in Wisconsin, having to do with people who retire from state service and then come back. They're collecting a retirement. Now they get a new wage from the state. I supported, first of all, the Democratic alternative to that because I thought that was more reasonable. But when that didn't pass, I supported the Republican bill on double dipping. There was a proposal that came up that had to do with the type of records that employers were required or not required to preserve relating to overtime. I supported the Republicans on that. I have supported the Republicans on a number of different gun issues. I've been endorsed by the National Rifle Association. I mean, I could go on and on. And it's because of that when I brought forward a bill that I thought had bipartisan appeal, my workforce adjustment training grant bill, the Republicans came up to me and said, you know, wouldn't just support any Democratic bill, but you've been good to us. You've been respectful. You've been fair. You've been trying to listen to us. I'll support your bill, too. That's really what it's all about, is not just talking about it, but actually doing it.
I think one of the things that both sides agrees on is, well, two things, really. I think one is jobs. We all agree that jobs are an issue in our state. We're trying to create jobs. We just have different ways of going about it, but in the end, we both agree on jobs. And also education. We all want what's best for our kids in education. Again, approaching it differently, but the bottom line is what's best for kids. And I think that talking to each other and understanding that base value can bring us together on those two issues, education and jobs.
Chris Hardy, editor of La Crosse Tribune. Question goes to Tracy.
The governor has proposed that anyone who receives public benefits in Wisconsin be subject to drug screening. Do you support that proposal, and would you support the same concept for any individual business or agency that receives public funds?
Yes, I support that. To go to work every day, to be able to be job ready, to have the skills, have yourself presentable, ready to go to a job, you need to be in the right frame of mind. Not if you're using substances or something, that's not going to help you be a successful person, and no matter what job you have, what level job you have. And In some instances, that's already in place. In some businesses, not that I'm tested as a teacher, but I can't go to work in that state of mind. And you know, if somebody does, we're called out on it. And a lot of jobs, you know, you already have to be responsible enough. So if you're looking for a job or at that stage in your life where you are struggling to find, you have to be presentable. You have to be in a clear, conscious state of mind in order to be ready to go to work every day and have the responsibilities of having a job.
I'm opposed to that proposal because, quite honestly, I think it's mean-spirited. I think that it doesn't solve a problem. You know, if the concern is that there are these people out there who are collecting unemployment, and the only reason they're collecting it is because they're lazy and they want to use drugs and they're not really serious about looking for work, I just find that offensive. I've only had one period in my life where I was unemployed, when I worked for a person who lost his job, and as a result, I lost mine. And I can tell you that was one of the lowest periods of self-esteem in my entire life. I just felt like I was worthless because I thought I had skills, but potential employers weren't interested in hiring me. And now to take a person in that situation and say, well, not only are you not, you know, working, but, you know, you got to come in and do regular drug testing, I just don't think that's appropriate. But, you know, the proposal that has been put forward is to require people who are on employment to take drug tests. But let me give you a scenario here. You got a person who had, let's say it's a guy who is 60 years old. He's been working in a business for decades. That business closes, or maybe it, you know, goes offshore. He loses his job, 60 years old, and he's out there trying to find work, and he's competing against the people that are right out of school. That person is going to have to take a drug test. Now let's take another person who is a young woman in her early 20s. She had kind of a wild teenage years, and she ended up having a child. She's now in her early 20s. This woman has not had a serious job. Maybe she's living with her parents, and she decides, I think I'm going to send my child to a voucher school. Does anybody ask her to take a drug test? Why do we have a dual standard? In both respects, you're getting a government benefit for something, and we're saying this person should have to meet one standard and this person should have to meet another standard. I don't agree that that's appropriate, and I also would expand it to the rest of your question. Any entity that receives government funding should all be held to the same standard.
Brad Williams, WIZM Radio. Your question is directed to Steve first.
A lot has been discussed about bipartisanship and also changing the tone in Madison, which has calmed down in the last few years since 2011. And if you are elected, what sort of goals would you have, both of you, to try to change the tone in the next 2 years and work more closely with the members of both parties?
Well, my answer is really easy. I'd keep doing the same thing I've been doing, because that is exactly what I promised the first time I got elected. It's what I promised the second time I got elected, and it's what I'm promising this time. I'm making one promise, and that is I will work with both parties to try to get things done for our state. I co-sponsored in this last session an equal number of Democratic and Republican bills, 90 each, because I don't think that either party has a monopoly on good ideas. And quite honestly, neither party has a monopoly on bad ideas either. There's some good ones and there's some bad ones from both sides, and you have to pick and choose what makes sense to you and what makes sense to your district. There's an organization called the Sunlight Foundation that takes a look nationwide at each individual state's legislature. And in Wisconsin, the Sunlight Foundation found that I was the third most moderate. In other words, the co-sponsoring Republican bills, voting for Republican bills, and so forth, which shows, not just from me saying it, but from an objective outside entity, that I'm putting my money where my mouth is. I have already talked on a couple of occasions about the bill that I passed that the Republicans supported. In my first session or first term, I had a proposal that would change Wisconsin from being the only state that charged parents a tax for having their adult children on their health insurance. We ended up repealing that. I brought forward that proposal. A Republican came up with the same idea. She and I worked together to pass her bill. I mean, I think that's how it should be. You know, Harry Truman once said, wouldn't it be amazing to think of how many good things we could accomplish if it didn't matter who got the credit? And that's really been my philosophy. I don't care if it's a Democrat or Republican bill. I don't care if it's my bill or somebody else's bill. If it's a good idea, I'm going to support it.
Bipartisanship is a big, big theme here, and it's interesting to hear those anecdotal, those stories, the things that you just shared. Checking the facts and looking at bills, Mr. Doyle has actually voted over the majority of time with his party. That's not bipartisanship. What is bipartisanship is actually listening, hearing, discussing, and finding that common ground and being willing to negotiate and not going the majority of time with the party, but going with what's right the majority of the time.
Well, I'd like to respond to that by simply saying, well, of course I vote most of the time with my party. If I voted most of the time with Republicans, I would become a Republican. I mean, but, you know, I support most of the issues that the Democrats propose, but I'm not afraid to go across the other side. There were 380 bills that were passed by the State Assembly by the legislature this year. I voted with my party 98% of the time. Sounds like almost unanimously. But guess what? This Republican Speaker of the Assembly, Robin Voss, I voted with him 92.63% of the time also. You know, I'm not afraid to vote with the Republicans. I'm wondering if you would be willing to vote more often than not with the Democrats if you were elected.
I would have to consider are you asking me directly?
Sure.
Okay. I'd have to consider what's being discussed and what the residents in the district want. I'd have to talk to them. It's not about me. It's not about what I want. A lot of this discussion is. But it's about what the residents want, so it would go back to that.
Okay, let's take one more question from the panel. Ellen France, League of Women Voters. Question goes to Tracy.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. With the concerns in the area about frack sand mining, perhaps damage to the water and to air quality, are we doing enough in our legislature, first of all, to determine whether or not there are safety issues and if there are to regulate and then to enforce what we need to do in that area?
I'm a four-time Ironman triathlete. That's the big Ironman, 140.6 miles. Four times I've done that, and we train often in Lake Wazee up in Black River Falls. That is a iron ore mine. It's a previous iron ore mine. It's reclaimed into this beautiful, beautiful park where if you swim straight across, it's 1 mile. You swim back, it's 2 miles. It's great. This beautiful beach and families. The reclamation issues, the environmental issues, totally taken care of. It's wonderful what can happen after a mine does its job in a community and then brings it back to a beautiful nature natural area, park, or in this Wazee case of a beautiful lake in a park. The safety issues are already in place. We have OSHA. Working within a community when a mine comes in and talking about how people are going to be safe, what kind of jobs, the longevity, the impact within the community can happen when the discussion occurs between the community and the mine.
If you look all around La Crosse County, outside of our borders, you'll see frack sand mines all over the place, especially north of here in Trempealeau and east of here in Monroe County. You don't see any in La Crosse County, and there's a good reason for that. And I'm proud to actually still be a member of La Crosse County Board. The reason why we don't have frack sand mines here, not that we're never going to, but in La Crosse County, it's going to have to be win-win. We have ordinances in place that would require communities to be compensated, require environmental standards to be met, and require this to be a win-win situation. Here's an interesting statistic that our highway commissioner mentioned once that really blew me away. If you take a fully loaded truck, whether it's got frack sand or it's got agricultural products or whatever it is, you take a fully loaded truck, that vehicle will do the same amount of damage to a road as 9,600 automobiles. One truck, 9,600 automobiles. So if you have a frack sand mine that's operating 24/7, maybe 365 days a year, going through town roads, imagine that those town roads that were supposed to last 30, 40, 50 years are now going to have to be replaced in 4 or 5 years. And guess what? The frac sand companies aren't paying a dime toward that. You may have a community of 500 or 1,000 or a couple thousand people that now they have an 8-mile stretch of town road that they have to pay for, and they didn't get any benefit. So, yes, I think that mining is fine as long as we make it win-win. And the proposal that actually my Democratic colleague from north of here, Kathleen Vineout, had put forward to have the state take over regulation was something I didn't support. In Tremplo, they need it because God help them up there with what's going on. But here, we don't want the state to step in and say, La Crosse County, even though you're doing a good job, we're going to put your regulations aside. So I think that we can make it win-win, and that's how I would support it.
You know, that's the power of local government, is being able to work with any mine that comes in and negotiate all of the reparations that would need to be done when a mine comes in, also negotiating the jobs and the impact that it's going to have. Communities get to negotiate that, get to talk about the mine, and they can say no if they choose to, or they can say, yep, come on in, provide some jobs, not only for this community, but it's going to ripple out and affect the state as well.
Boy, I don't know what, other than La Crosse County, I don't know where you're seeing that happen. I mean, if you take a look at Tremplo, for example, if a mining company wants to open a mine in a town and the town says, no, we need some money to pay for our roads and we want some environmental protections, what do? They annex into the city right next door and say, too bad, town, you're out of luck. Now we're part of the city. We can do what we want. That is not win-win. That is not local government working with the mines.
Okay, I lied. We have one more panel question, and then we'll get to closing statements. From Bob Schmidt of today's talk on 1490, you can address your question to Steve first.
All right, Steve, early voting started yesterday. The opportunity to vote is a great privilege. However, many people don't use that privilege. How can we get more people out to the polls to vote?
Did you say voting is a privilege or early voting is a privilege?
Both. Voting in general is a privilege.
Okay, I would disagree with that. I think it's a right. I don't think it's a privilege. I think it's a right, and that is the problem, is that too many people in government think that it's a privilege, but it is a right. And I think it is important to get people out, and I think having these kinds of forums are important for people to know what's going on. As I said in my opening comments, I think we should have more debates and fewer attack ads. I think we should make it easier for people to vote. You know, when you look at the history of our country, you know, we started out that the only people who could vote were white male landowners. And over the generations, you know, now we, you know, eventually we had, you didn't have to be a landowner. Then you didn't have to be white. Then you didn't have to be a male. Then we changed it so that people who were, you know, between 18 and 21 could vote. We were always making it easier and easier because that's what we believed democracy was all about. Then all of a sudden, in the last couple of years or so, we suddenly have this big fear that there's somebody out there that is going to be engaging in voter fraud. And so in the state of Wisconsin, as Judge Edelman determined, you know, to prevent one or two people from fraudulently voting, we disenfranchised 300,000. There's no other situation in which we do that. We don't say that because there are some, you know, a handful of drunk drivers out there that we're going to make everybody, as soon as they leave a tavern, take a breath test. I mean, you know, and there's a more present danger of drunk drivers than there is of fraudulent voters in this state. But we don't take that approach, and I think that is wrong. We should increase the amount of early voting. We should increase the hours that our municipal clerks can have their offices open so that people can vote. We should increase the ability of people to be able to vote that don't have the perfect form of ID. That's democracy, and what we're doing right now is not democracy.
Voting is a constitutional right. It's just the basic democratic process. It's such a wonderful gift to have in our country. You talked about, you asked about having people, more people vote and supporting that people to be able to vote. We've got some great supports in place right now. Polls are open. We can do early voting. We can do absentee voting. Voting is the same time. Every voting session, we know exactly when it's going to be. Continuing to educate the public about when voting is and having the commercials and having people talk about it, having people, the community engaged in the democratic process and talking with their friends, that's how we get people out to vote. For people who want to vote, the absentee, all that I just said, but also the services that are out there to help people vote, the transportation that can get their churches and community groups have come together to get people out to vote. It's a right. It's a constitutional right, and we have wonderful things in place to be able to help people vote.
Okay, we'll have each candidate will have 2 minutes for closing statements, and you can go first, Tracy.
Well, I wanted to again thank Dr. Heim, the UWL, and the Political Science Department, our panel, everyone for coming out and asking questions and listening to the answers. I've enjoyed also, I wanted to thank the people that I've met out in the district for taking the time to talk with me at their doors and at the different events that we've held around the area. I've enjoyed all of this entire process, and it's exciting. It's 2 weeks from today that this will be over, and it's such a fun chapter in my life. I'm coming to you today not as a career politician. It's not something I want to do as a career. I want to involve myself in the political process as a wife, as a mother, as an educator, as a member of this community, as a person interested in politics, and being able to listen to what's going on in the community and bring it back to Madison and do the best job that I can for as long as people will have me. My family, I have, like I said, I've said it a few times, 3 children, 2 of whom are going to college in the fall. I understand the issues that are impacting our families and our district today, the taxes, the education issues, the responsibilities that we have as families, and I hope that I get the opportunity from your vote to take those things to Madison, those concerns you have, and do the very, very best that I can with all of the skills, all of the experience that I've encompassed in my life, and do the very best job I can for you. Thank you for your time. I very much appreciate it.
I also want to thank the sponsors. I want to thank the panel. I want to thank you, the audience. And I want to thank Tracy for participating in this. You know, so far this campaign has been what campaigns should be like. Everything that I have seen thus far, and don't disappoint me, Tracy, but everything I've seen so far is that Tracy is an energetic, sincere person. She has told you what her position is on the issues, and you can make a choice based upon the issues from what you have heard each of us say. And I have tried to be very clear my position on the various issues. I've talked about where I agree with my party. I've talked about where I disagree with my party. I don't believe that Ms. Happel has, in fact, said any examples of places where she disagrees with her party. She says there are some areas that parties can work together, jobs and education, and I agree with that. But sometimes my party's wrong, and at least in my opinion, and I feel like I have to cross over. And I think that's really an important consideration. I don't just talk about bipartisanship. It's not a feel-good thing for me. It is the way that I have tried to represent the people of my district. I said in the beginning, and I'll say it again, there's only one promise that I'm going to make tonight, the same promise that I made last time and the time before that. If you reelect me, I'm going to go to Madison. I'm going to work in a bipartisan fashion for you, the people of my district. I'm going to work my heart out. I'm going to try to do the best thing for my district, and I'm not going to make a bunch of promises that I don't intend to keep. If you reward me with a return to Madison, that's my promise to you. So I would respectfully ask for your vote tonight. Thank you very much.
And now, could we get a big bipartisan clap for both candidates for sure?